Well, thanks very much, Melissa, for that kind introduction. I'm very happy to be here to speak to Women in Banking and Finance, with the new rebranding, about the evolving financial situation. Now, one problem about giving a speech about the evolving financial situation is that the financial system actually keeps on evolving. So you'll excuse me if I don't break out the BlackBerry a couple of times during my speech just to make sure it hasn't evolved again underneath me while I'm talking. So it's getting on for nearly 3 years since the onset of the financial crisis that has bedeviled us for most of the intervening time. And it is actually 3 years, almost 3 years ago, since it began. And for some of us, including me, it seems a hell of a lot more than 3 years. Thankfully, though, there are signs of a sizable improvement in many markets in recent months. But I believe it's still premature to declare victory. So while the general trend has been positive over the last 9 months or so, there are a number of risks still lingering, and I'll talk a bit about them later on. So what I want to do today is just to summarise the state of play in three major parts of the Australian and global financial markets. Talk about the credit market, equity markets, and the foreign exchange market. And I'll also describe the actions that the Reserve Bank took in response to the evolving turmoil in markets over the past 3 years. And reflecting the fact that in Australia, markets have generally functioned better than those in other developed economies, the need for policy intervention by the Reserve Bank was considerably less than other central banks around the world. Moreover, most of the actions that we took in the local market have been completely unwound. But before I describe the state of play in markets, let me just step back and give my very quick potted summary of the cause of the financial turmoil, or one of the causes. And I've said this before, but the main thing I attribute a very large role in the financial crisis to is a wholesale failure of risk management and risk assessment. So to give you an idea of the failure of risk assessment, I'll use a quote I've used before from David Vinier, the CFO of Goldman Sachs. And he said this in August 2007, so just after BNP and the Bear Stearns funds had got into trouble. So he said, "We are seeing things that were 25 standard deviation moves several days in a row." So remember, this is August 2007, so things hadn't really started getting going much by that point. So the month of October 2008, on Vinier's in terminology, delivered significantly more 25 standard deviation events. But for those of you who aren't statistically minded, let me just give you an idea of what a 25 standard deviation event is. If you have a normal distribution, which is the normal statistical distribution, a 25 standard deviation event is actually a once-in-a-lifetime event. It's actually not once-in-our-lifetime event, it's actually once-in-the universe's lifetime event. So here he is saying that he's seen a few of them a few days in a row. So that probably suggests that the distribution you're looking at is probably wrong. And those distributions were what underpinned a lot of the risk management models in a lot of financial institutions and financial regulators, for that matter. So it just shows you that the wholesale failure of risk management and risk assessment that occurred. And that, as I said, that applied to models used by investors, by financial institutions, by issuers and by regulators. It was right across the board. So with that in mind, let me turn to where everything began, which was in the credit markets. And that was probably where the failure of risk management and risk assessment was the greatest. But it was also the place where the realisation first occurred that risks had been badly miscalculated. Indeed, for most of the second half of 2007, credit markets were a long way ahead of other markets in seeing the problems which were to come. Other markets, and most obviously the equity markets, remained generally unaware of what was unfolding in the credit world, and there was actually quite a disconnect between them. So asset-backed markets were where concerns first arose, particularly obviously securities backed by US subprime mortgages, with some of those securities as probably being a bit generous to refer to them as asset-backed. In the first half of 2007, great uncertainty arose about the quality and value of those securities and the assets that underpinned them. There was further uncertainty about whose books those assets resided on, generating a marked rise in counterparty risk amongst financial institutions. That is, institutions became much less willing to lend to each other, both because of concerns about the financial strength of their counterparty, as well as a desire to hoard any available liquidity should they themselves need it. So this is most, you've probably seen this picture a few times, but it's most obviously manifest in this graph, which shows you the spread between LIBOR, or bank bills in the case of Australia, and the expected policy rate at the three-month horizon. And it's probably this spread here is probably the best way of showing the evolution of the financial crisis and the fluctuation in financial market tensions over the past 3 years. So as is apparent in the graph, the yellow line, which is Australia, is considerably lower and much less volatile than that in other markets. And this reflects the fact that the tensions were a lot less here than elsewhere. The balance sheets of Australian banks were considerably stronger than those in other countries. They didn't have material holdings of or exposure to the securities backed by US mortgages. Moreover, the quality of the loans on the books of the banks in Australia, which were almost entirely domestic, very little lending offshore, was almost materially better than in most other banking systems. More generally, the counterparty concerns in the local market were generally much less here than elsewhere. No one was particularly worried about a bank in Australia falling over. The Lehman event is also very apparent on the graph. That's that big spike. Yeah? And in fact, that spike is only indicative. There was no trading in these markets at that time. There was at least some attempt to try and measure it. So prior to Lehman's, markets were clearly disrupted, but there was a sense that the situation was generally manageable. In the period immediately after Lehman's, there was fears that the system was out of control. There were a few periods, in fact, in the weeks after that, where the only market with any significant liquidity around the world was on-the-run US Treasuries. Spreads widened significantly following the Lehman failure from already high levels. Counterparty concerns were at their zenith. There was little confidence about who was going to fall over next. The significant dislocation in markets following Lehman's, and if you remember, at the same time you had the run or the breaking of the buck of the money market mutual fund reserve, which was almost as traumatic an event, the rescue of AIG, Fannie and Freddie, and they resulted obviously in large-scale interventions by governments around the world. In many advanced economies, schemes were put in place to support securities markets, which were with a whole bunch of acronyms, particularly in the US, which was an alphabet soup of programs. Governments also guaranteed the deposits and debt raisings of their financial institutions. So while, pointing back to Australia, the markets here were dislocated through this period, the dislocation was generally less, well, considerably less, and shorter-lived. And so we weren't required to intervene to the extent necessary in other countries. I'll come back to that again in a minute. Nevertheless, the government, as you all know, introduced a guarantee on wholesale debt and deposits. So with a guarantee in place in most other countries around the world, Australian banks would have been at a significant competitive disadvantage in terms of their funding, and particularly in terms of their funding costs, had they not had the guarantee. In addition, the guarantee allowed the Australian banks to access another group of investors who had an appetite for sovereign credit rather than bank credit. So the Australian banks made fairly extensive use of the government guarantee of their debt. So this graph here shows you bond issuance in Australia over the period of the financial crisis. So the red bit is guaranteed issuance by financial institutions. The dark blue bit is unguaranteed issuance. So the need to use the guarantee by the Australian banks for the most part reflected the high risk aversion of investors. And it was as much an issue of price as market access. So that is, the guarantee allowed the banks to raise funds considerably cheaper than they could without it. It also allowed them to issue at longer maturities. So as I said, it was mostly an issue of price. It was also an issue of maturity. Even in the worst of the crisis, and I think this is a point which is often unappreciated, and so in the last quarter of 2008, the Australian banks were still able to roll over their short-term wholesale funding, both on and offshore, without using the guarantee. The guarantee was generally used for the term issues. As risk aversion has dissipated and spreads have narrowed, there has been an increase in unguaranteed issuance. For some months now, for the major banks, the cost of issuing unguaranteed debt, particularly at shorter maturities, has been no higher and often lower than the cost of issuing guaranteed debt, once account is taken for the guarantee fee. And you can see from this picture that this led to an increase in unguaranteed issuance and a decline in guaranteed issuance. That is, the price mechanism which was put in place for the guarantee actually worked. So reflecting the improvement in market conditions and the continued strength of the Australian banking system, the Treasurer has announced that the guarantee of wholesale debt will cease at the end of March. It's also from the graph I showed you a minute ago, it is apparent the spreads have narrowed considerably over the second half of 2009. This is true both at shorter maturities but also at longer maturities. And that demonstrates a considerable improvement in credit market conditions and the abatement of risk aversion. And the improving conditions have also been reflected in the increase in issuance. So, as you can see here, the issuance in December and September quarters was some of the largest issuance we've ever seen in the Australian market. A further indication of the improvement in conditions is that the banks here have been increasing the maturity of their debt in recent months. They have tended to reduce the use of short-term bills in their funding and increase the share of longer-term debt, including a number of 7- and 10-year issues. Securitisation markets have also begun to show some signs of life since around about the end of last year. There have been sizable RMBS issues in the last few months by ME Bank, formerly known as Members Equity, Bendigo and Adelaide, Westpac, and most recently AMP and BOQ. So one reason for this, so we've got here, so that's those blue bars at the end there of this graph, which is up until including last week. You can see there the issuance prior to the crisis through 06 and 07, the high level of RMBS issuance, very little issuance in 2008, the AOFM doing most of the buying in the first part of 2009, and then the return to issuance directly into the market over the last couple of months. So one reason for the pickup in the market is that the stock of RMBS on issue has declined significantly because this stuff is still amortising at the rate it always has, about 25-30% per year. So investors who bought this stuff have holes in their portfolios to fill. Now, some of those investors aren't around anymore, most notably the CIVs, so they don't have any holes to fill, but the other investors do. The current pace of issuance that we're seeing at the moment is around about the level necessary to keep the stock at its current level, and it's actually not that far as a share of housing credit than it was during earlier in the decade, in 2006 and 2007. So moreover, I think the secondary market overhang caused by the portfolio liquidation of a number of the CIVs who bought this stuff earlier has been largely eliminated, and that's seen secondary market spreads tightened considerably, which has helped the primary market again as well. You can actually think of securitisation as being somewhere around a 3- or 4-year bond in terms of bank funding, given the effective life of an RMBS. So the spreads on the recent issues that we've seen are only a bit higher than those on the recent unguaranteed issues by the major banks at an equivalent maturity, and that gap's actually narrowing. So if you think about the regional banks in particular and the non-bank lenders, that means that RMBS is actually a cost-effective and competitive source of funding for them again. So let me now turn to the equity markets and show what's happened, what went on there. So the red line, if you can see it well, is 2007, and what I've done here is just lined that up with a few other big events in the history of the Australian equity market. So the equity markets took a lot longer to be affected by the financial crisis. Continuing to rise through much of the second half of 2007, the equity market actually peaked in November 2007. But for the general public, at least, the equity market was probably the most obvious manifestation of the crisis. So this graph shows, as I said, how this stacks up with previous big movements. So the current episode was one of the most rapid declines, with only 87 being faster, and it's nearly as deep as the largest decline, which was 1973. The local market moved broadly in line with other global markets, notwithstanding the fact that the Australian economy was outperforming the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world. Equity markets in many emerging market economies, which were at least as strong, generally fell by even more than equity markets in advanced economies. And the best example of this is the Chinese stock market, which experienced a peak-to-trough decline of 70%. These large declines in equity prices resulted in a very large destruction of household wealth, which is why everyone in the general public noticed it. But a large proportion of that decline in household wealth has been regained since the trough in equity markets in March 2009. Because while the decline was one of the sharpest on records, the rebound has also been relatively rapid. And by way of example, in China, where the decline was 70%, the Chinese equity market has risen by as much as over 100% subsequently. One marked feature of the Australian equity market over the crisis was the record amount of equity raisings that occurred. So the light green bars here are equity raisings on an annual basis over the last decade or so. So Australian companies raised just shy of $100 billion over the course of last year. Some part of this equity raising reflected businesses turning to equity as a source of funds in the face of a tightening in lending standard by the banks, which they did either voluntarily or slightly involuntarily. And equity market is also the equity is also being used to replace debt issues as they came to maturity. But one important fact to remember is those equity raisings were generally not very cheap. They often occurred at a sizeable discount to the prevailing stock price at that time. And as I've noted from the graph I just showed you a minute ago, equity prices have rebounded significantly since then. So it was a good buy if you bought into those equity raisings at the time, not so good necessarily for the company as a cheap source of finance, particularly with the benefit of hindsight, obviously. That large amount of equity raising that, I show here for 2009 has got a fair bit to do with the decline in business credit that we've seen of late. So this graph is a little bit hard to read, but anyhow, you can, when you look at the printed version of it, it'll be a little bit easier. The red line is total business external funding. The greyish bars are equity raisings and the blue bars are business credit. So if you just look at the right, far right-hand end, you can see that the last three blue bars are negative, decent drops in business credit. But they've been more than offset by the rise in equity raising. So throughout much of 2009, the red line shows you that business funding has actually been going at an okay rate despite the negative growth in business credit. So companies have been, as I said, have been using their equity raisings to pay down debt and have turned away from intermediated credit through the banking system to raise funds directly from the market. Let me now turn to the third market before I get on to talking a bit about what we've done and just talk briefly about the FX market. So I gave a speech on this late last year, and so I'm really only going to say a quick recap of what I said then. You can see here the very large swings in the Australian dollar over the past 18 months. The currency depreciated by over 30% from its peak in July 2008 to its trough in March 2009, but it's got back nearly all of that, so it's not much more than 5% below its peak. And those swings in the exchange rate have played an important role in buttressing the economy from the shocks that have been hitting the global economy. Some of that big depreciation and subsequent appreciation reflects the movement in risk aversion that's also evident in the money market spreads. In fact, this is not a bad barometer for global financial market sentiment either. And indeed, the Australian dollar was often cited as a barometer of that. So this is most evident in this graph, which shows you the correlation between the S&P 500 and the Aussie. And you can see through about the middle of 2008 or late 2008, the whole way through 2009, a very strong correlation between the Aussie and the S&P 500. And you can see also in the last period that correlation's dropped right away. We had another version we published in one of our statements about a year or so ago where we looked at the correlation between the S&P 500 and the Aussie in the last hour of trading in New York, so between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock. And in 2009, that correlation was basically 1. So as the S&P was getting dumped, the Aussie was getting dumped. In part, this correlation was high because as risk aversion increased, investors retreated to their home markets, repatriating their holdings of foreign assets. In addition, there were obviously a number of highly leveraged investors who were forced to liquidate their portfolios that often included Australian dollar investments. They weren't liquidating their portfolios because of their Australian dollar investments, but because of all the losses they had in their other parts of their portfolios. Significant flows were also generated by non-leveraged investments with foreign equity investments. So a lot of domestic fund managers who had hedged their US dollar equity portfolios were having to make sizable adjustments to their hedges, and we saw a lot of those flows, particularly in the second half of 2008. So notwithstanding the fact that the Aussie foreign exchange market is generally very liquid, there were occasions when liquidity became scarce, particularly around the time of maximum risk aversion just following Lehman. That marked reduction in liquidity prompted us, being the Reserve Bank, to enter the market to mitigate that liquidity shortfall. One point we always like to stress is that we're not seeking to maintain any particular level of the exchange rate. In fact, we were quite happy with the way the exchange rate was moving in general terms, in terms of providing a buffer to the economy. Rather, we were seeking to address the market dysfunction that was resulting from the significant lack of liquidity in that market. The reserves that we used in that foreign exchange intervention have been subsequently repurchased in full in a way that has minimised any impact on the market. A lot of those flows that we saw in the immediate aftermath of Lehman's were incredibly small flows, and most of them were associated with people adjusting hedges, and there really wasn't a hell of a lot of other transactions going through the market. The reason why we know that was for a while there, for a few days, we were the only person on the other side of the market. So let me now turn more generally to the actions that we've done during the crisis outside of the policy rate decisions. So one summary way to compare what we did with what some other central banks have been doing and are still doing is to show you the evolution of our balance sheet. So this just shows you the size, just the size of our balance sheet over the course of the last 18 months or so. And so you can see there, just following the Lehman's event, a sizable increase in the size of our balance sheet. And in fact, on this scale at least, it was about the same order of magnitude of that as the ECB, obviously considerably less than that of the Bank of England and that of the Fed. It also shows you that increase in our balance sheet has now been completely unwound, unlike the case of the other three where that increase in their balance sheet is still there. Another important difference between what we did and what the other central banks did is that here the increase resulted predominantly through our regular market operations. We didn't really have to introduce a whole bunch of new facilities with new acronyms. In contrast, the bulk of the increase in the UK and the US is from direct purchases of government securities or mortgage-backed securities in the case of the US. We haven't done any of that here. So the actions that we took were mostly or almost entirely conducted within our pre-existing framework for market operations. So in our market operations, this is in the domestic money market on a daily basis, we always have dealt with a wide range of counterparties, and which are not just banks, as is often mistakenly thought, but actually a wide range of counterparties. Like anyone can be a counterparty, provided you meet certain conditions. And we have always had the capacity to adjust the terms of our operations very quickly. Because we operate in the market every single day, it's relatively straightforward for us to assess the degree of tension in the market and respond accordingly. Our operating system is fairly flexible, and we availed ourselves of that flexibility throughout the crisis period. Obviously, it was a lot easier for us by the fact that we didn't face the difficulties that were faced in some of the other countries. But I think it's the case that the framework we have established over a number of years made our life a lot easier as well than the somewhat arcane frameworks that are in place in a couple of other countries. The extent of liquidity we provided directly to the cash market can be gauged by looking at the evolution of exchange settlement balances, which up until the crisis was something which no one paid any attention to whatsoever, but got a bit of attention subsequently. So these are the balances that our counterparties hold with us on an overnight basis. So all deposit-taking institutions have to have an ES balance with us, and it has to be positive at all times, but there are other counterparties who can also hold balances with us. As counterparty risk rose throughout this period, so starting in the beginning of 2007, you can see various spikes in ES balances, particularly over quarter ends, as banks were inclined to hold larger precautionary balances with us, as I said, particularly through the end of a quarter. To allow us to provide assistance to the debt market by undertaking more repos without putting undue pressure on the overnight cash market. So the ES balances is actually the market where we set the cash rate for monetary policy. So the board tells us what the cash rate is, we set it in this market. It's the rate in this particular market. So when we were grossing up our balance sheet, we wanted to make sure that we weren't putting undue downward pressure on the cash rate by ending up with too many ES balances. So in late October, we introduced a term deposit facility, which is effectively an ES balance held at term. The term was only about 1 or 2 weeks normally. And you can see that's the yellow on the graph there. You can see that increase through the end of 2008. So the balances held with us peaked around March 2009 at the height of global risk aversion. And notwithstanding a recent seasonal increase at the end of last year, ES balances are back to around $1.5 billion, and banks no longer have any term deposits with us. So they're basically that form of our liquidity support to the market has been completely unwound. The other thing we did in our market operations to provide some certainty to the longer-term funding for financial institutions is that we offered 6-month and one-term repos on a daily basis starting from October 2008. As demand for that has diminished, we have ceased offering those terms daily, although we are still willing to deal at those longer terms if someone comes into us with an offer which is attractive enough for us and which suits our liquidity management objectives. Another action we took was to expand the sphere of collateral eligible for our market operations. So we now accept all AAA-rated paper. So we haven't gone any lower than AAA-rated paper. We've just broadened the sphere of AAA-rated paper that we accept, except for highly structured paper. And as I said before, we intend to maintain that wider collateral pool in our market operations. A further change to our collateral policy we made was to accept so-called self-securitisation or self-securitised mortgage-backed securities. which is when an institution puts together a normal RMBS on it, but it holds it on its own book rather than sells it into the market. So our counterparties made extensive use of this, particularly as collateral for our longer-term repos. So if I actually show you our balance sheet, if you can read these numbers, this is our balance sheet at the end of June 2008, at the end of December 2008, which was roughly when it was at its biggest, and then as of a couple of weeks ago. And if you can read it, the line I'm sort of most interested in is on the bottom half, the RMBS self-securitised. So you can see in June 2008, we had none of them on our balance sheet. At end of December 2008, they were 45% of the assets on our balance sheet. And as of the end of January, they were down to 22%. So as those repos, so we were doing them, and they were a lot of the time they were collateral for our one-year operation. We're more than 1 year on, quite a lot more than 1 year on since when we started doing that. A lot of those have matured, and so the share in our balance sheet has gone down again. Finally, in the last thing in terms of operations we did was that along with a number of other central banks in October 2008, we established a foreign exchange swap facility with the Fed. That facility was introduced to address the dislocation or the global shortage of US dollars outside the US, which was causing a substantial dislocation in swap markets. Under that swap facility, we, the Reserve Bank, auctioned US dollars directly to our domestic counterparties in exchange for domestic collateral. And we were effectively acting as an agent for the Fed, but we were the ones who ultimately held the risk. The Fed only held the risk that we wouldn't repay them, not that our counterparties wouldn't repay. So we took our normal haircuts on that collateral, but given that we also had a currency mismatch involved here, we also took a larger than normal margin on that collateral to protect us from exchange rate movements. Usage of the Fed swap facility peaked at around December 2008, was last used here in April 2009, and had nothing outstanding under it by about June 2009, and as of the beginning of this month, it was formally terminated. So the Fed has terminated all its FX swap lines with other central banks. So the main message I want you to take away from this is that the RBA did provide assistance to contribute to the smoother functioning of financial markets through the turbulence, but the assistance we were required to provide was considerably less than in most other countries, and importantly, we've been able to unwind that as market conditions have improved, in fact, basically unwound it in full. So, as I've said, there's been a significant improvement in financial market conditions since their nadir just over a year ago. However, risks remain, and I want to spend the last bit of my speech just talking a bit about them. So let me make it clear that I don't see these downside risks really in Australian or Asian financial markets, but rather in the North Atlantic markets of the US, Europe and the UK. And while this financial crisis is often called a global financial crisis, it's more accurately described a North Atlantic financial crisis. And if you can remember back in 1997, the North Atlantic countries were quite happy to call that the Asian financial crisis. But this time around, it can't be their financial crisis, it's got to be a global financial crisis. So while most of the recent jitters in the last few weeks have been associated with sovereign concerns, I actually think the risks stemming from the financial sector are still out there. So to some extent, you can think about the last 3 years as problems which originated in the financial sector, to some extent, feeding into the macroeconomy. So June 2007, macroeconomy sort of going okay, risks started to arise in the financial sector, feeding into the macroeconomy. We're now in the phase where the weakness in the macroeconomy is feeding back into the financial sector. In that regard, a significant risk in my assessment is that we are still yet to see the full impact of the weakness in the North Atlantic economies on the loans on the books of financial institutions. The bulk of the losses to date by those institutions have been write-downs in the value of securities held on their books. So while these write-downs have been absorbed, albeit with some difficulty and with some substantial capital raisings, given the size of the output contraction that we've seen, one would expect that we are not all that far advanced in the adverse credit cycle that normally accompanies recessions, and this has not been a normal recession in the North Atlantic. For the North Atlantic economies, this was a big recession which, combined with large falls in both commercial and housing prices, should result in large loan losses, and we still are only a little way into that process, I think. So last May, you might remember, the US authorities released the results of a stress test of their 19 largest financial institutions, and they concluded that those institutions could survive a scenario pretty much in line with what we're seeing at the moment. In some cases, survival was predicated on the raising of additional capital, and where that was required, that actually has subsequently occurred. So I think one can be reasonably confident in the ability of those institutions to absorb the deterioration in their loan books which is yet to come. My concern is actually more with the second tier and beyond of the US financial sector. This lower tier, which is a sizeable share of the US financial sector, has loan portfolios which are very regionally concentrated with a sizeable weighting to commercial property in their area. The experience of previous cycles indicates that the commercial property cycle takes a long time to unfold, and I think we may have some way yet to travel on that. These problems in the banking system will almost certainly hinder credit provision in the US, particularly to the SME sector, which doesn't have the direct access to capital markets that larger corporates have. So even though one might be relatively confident that the major financial institutions have the ability to absorb the loan losses still to come, there might be also a concern that there could have an adverse effect on public confidence should those institutions report further quarterly losses. The general public might be somewhat surprised that losses are continuing to occur given the amount of support that they've given to these institutions. But while those risks are there in the North Atlantic, they are not present in this part of the world. In Asia, bank balance sheets have remained in sound condition throughout, and that's obviously clearly true in Australia. And hence, there is no impediment to credit provision. Indeed, there is a marked contrast between the balance of risks in the North Atlantic and in Asia. While the near-term risks may be on the downside in the US and Europe, they would appear to be on the upside in Asia. In fact, the interplay between the contrasting fortunes of these two parts of the world is likely to be the critical factor in determining the evolution of the global economy, and Australia is clearly now more tied to one region than it is to the other, and that's obviously changed a lot over the past decade. But those are risks, not the central case. The central case is that financial markets have improved considerably over the past year. That's self-evident. This improvement has allowed a sizable portion of the investments of the interventions in financial markets undertaken by central banks over the past 3 years to be unwound. In the US, most of those additional programs that they put in place with all those acronyms also wound up on February the 1st at the same time as they closed down the US dollar facility. In Australia, this has been particularly true. The measures that we undertook to support the local financial market were considerably less, given the local financial market was considerably less dislocated than other markets, and all of those measures have basically been unwound. So let me finish there, and I'm happy to take questions. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Dr. DeBell. Joshua Williamson, Citigroup. My question relates to what's happening in European sovereign debt markets at the moment and its impact on Australia. It's very clear, just looking at the statistics, that there's very little direct trade exposure between Australia and those Club Med countries that are currently involved in those debt and deficit issues. I'm just wondering, do you or the Reserve Bank have an opinion on whether there'll be any financial market dislocation with respect to the potential for banks and corporates to obtain finance at a more expensive rate or be some rationing of credit, and whether that would have any implications for financial conditions in Australia?
I'm not sure. I think there's a reasonable separation between the bank credit markets and the sovereign markets. In fact, at the moment, the sovereign dislocation is really confined to European countries. Even if you look at spreads of emerging market sovereigns, both in Asia and in Latin America in particular, those spreads actually haven't moved up at all, really. It's been confined predominantly to the European region. So there's even a fair degree of separation within the sovereign market with Greece and some of the other countries with the large fiscal problems being singled out. So I don't think the dislocation has even flowed yet from that part of the sovereign market to other parts of the sovereign market. And I don't really think... The bank credit market is another step removed again. Now, I don't want to get in the business of trying to predict where credit markets are going to go from here, because that's been a mug's game for the last 3 years. Before then, it was quite easy. So I'm not saying that doesn't mean there isn't going to be any, but at this stage, we don't see any evidence of that, that the markets have been... It's been fairly confined to a reasonably narrow part of the sovereign market.
Hi, it's Daniel Blake from ARIA. Just had a question with regards to one of the proposals by Olivier Blanchard from the IMF on Friday. And given that most of these North Atlantic financial crisis-affected economies have hit their soft liquidity trap bounds for monetary policy, what do you think of the notion of lifting the inflation target to something like 4%? And has the higher inflation banned for the Reserve Bank been beneficial with regards to comparing it to the 1% to 2% implicit or explicit targets of those other economies?
No, I actually studied under Olivier, so I don't want to say anything. I suppose we are very comfortable with our inflation target where it is. I'm not sure that you could blame the level of the inflation target as being any contributing. So have countries hit their zero lower bound? Yes, they have. Was it a result of their inflation target? No, I don't think so. The Japanese managed to hit their zero lower bound sometime in the mid-90s without any inflation target, quite comfortably. The Fed didn't have an inflation target, hit its zero lower bound. I'm not sure that the level of the inflation target has had much to do with hitting the lower bound. It's the nature of the crisis which has had a lot to do with the hitting of the lower bound. So in Australia, I think we're very comfortable with the inflation target where it is. I think the other concern about raising, I think Olivier's may have thrown out 4 as a number which he might contemplate. Well, and we had this debate, for those of you who can remember, back in the mid-90s as to what was an appropriate level of the inflation target, and why not 4, why not 5, why not 6, why not 7. Now, we know at some point the number's too high, but generally, we've had a very successful track record of keeping inflation consistent with our target. The public is used to that. Their expectations are centred on that. Hasn't caused us any operational difficulties, so I think we're quite comfortable with our inflation target where it is.
Hi. You made a point about the corporate lending environment in Australia being better than offshore, which I agree with. However, I do wonder, with a lot of corporates deleveraging or the best corporates issuing in the public market rather than going to the banks, that you have a problem sometime in the future with some of the worst corporates left on the bank's balance sheets. I'm just wondering if you see this as a potential problem sometime in the future in the financial industry.
No, I don't think so. I think that market segmentation's always been there, that those who are able to access the offshore access the capital markets directly do. And assuming that the bank's credit policies are adequately followed, then there shouldn't be a problem. I don't see that causing a problem down the track. It's sort of ever been thus. And actually what happened through part of 2008 was actually there was a re-intermediation process because corporate debt markets were shut. A lot of corporates who normally would access the corporate debt market came back to the banks, so corporates the banks hadn't seen for a few years. So those people have now gone back to accessing the market directly. So I think where we are now is really back where we were a few years ago in terms of the composition of banks' corporate books.
Dr. DeBell, Phil Lasker from the ABC. I refer to the RBA's paper that was delivered at the recent symposium, where the message seemed to be that the quicker governments rein in their spending and stimulus, the lower interest rates can be. I note that there was a specific mention that this didn't apply to Australia, but it does apply to Australia, doesn't it?
I think that's a question which is probably... I can guarantee that there'll be at least 3 hours of questioning on this topic on Friday when the Governor appears before the Parliamentary Committee, where they'll spend 3 hours trying to get him to answer this question one way or the other. So I think in the interest of not preempting Glenn, I think it's better... I'm going to leave that question for him. I can guarantee you will get that question asked on Friday and there will be an answer to it.
Thanks, Guy. One of the... causes of the global financial crisis, or the North Atlantic financial crisis, as you like to call it, has been the mispricing of risk by financial institutions. What changes have you seen in the way that risk is now priced, and where do you think change is still needed?
I mean, I think it's interesting. So that's right. There was a complete mispricing of risk prior to mid-2007. Then what happened, there was a complete mispricing of risk from 2007 onwards, but in the opposite direction. So, and the best example is actually the equity market. So if you look at that fall in the equity market, spreads more generally, we went from a period of almost no risk aversion to a period of complete risk aversion, and now we've retreated back to something. I mean, I'm not saying risk is correctly priced now, but at least it's something closer to where it probably should be. So actually, throughout, throughout a lot of the crisis there was actually a repricing of risk in the other direction as people got incredibly conservative. I think it's woken up, or it's made it clear to financial institutions just about some of the linkages within their own institutions. I mean, there's a reasonably well-known example of one institution where mortgage-backed securities were being sold out of one part of the institution who had a reasonably good idea about the risks associated with them. They were then bought back in by another part of the institution, and then the part of the institution which sold it was stunned to find out that this other part of the institution had bought them back, particularly when their bonuses were affected by it. So I think there is a better assessment of looking at risks on a whole-of-institution basis by financial institutions. It's obviously affected the way boards perceive things and the questions they're likely to ask and what and issues which would have been glossed over in the past will have a lot more attention paid to them. I think risk management committees are now certainly they report directly into the board, if not to the CEO, and obviously they're being listened to now. That doesn't mean 5, 6, 7 years down the track that will still be the case. But I think the wake-up call that everyone's had to risk means obviously a lot of attention is being paid to it in the way that it was, the way that it was measured, and the way that it was handled within an institution. Now, as I said, how long the effect of that will last remains to be seen. But there are some of the reforms which are coming out of Basel will also require institutions to pay more attention to the risks that they have on their balance sheets as well. So I think that will ensure that there is some long-lasting impact on risk management within institutions.